Welcome to the 16th episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast with your co-host Eric Drysdale and
Jared Hunter.
On today's episode, we will be doing something a little bit different than our other episodes. Jared and I are going to be discussing our personal experiences and thoughts on the last 3 years of life since COVID. Specifically, we'll be talking about how our views have changed over this period of time and how it's affected many of the topics that we have talked about in previous episodes, either between ourselves or with our guests. So Jared, I'm just going to get this started off by asking you, what are some things that you think you've learned on a personal level since the pandemic started?
Yeah, so this was a tough one for me. The one topic, like there's a lot of little specific things, I guess. I'll give some examples. It's like, what is the point at which I overload on news and global affairs? I learned that through COVID. There was a lot of habits I know I relied on to keep myself like on task. One habit that I always had was like, whenever I was going to go and put in a long work session, I would go somewhere else. So like that obviously highlighted how important that was to me. So like, but I guess to kind of put it all together, I think a lot of these things were just like, there's a lot of limits that I was able to identify about myself. How much information am I willing to process? And like, what are these habits that I rely on and these actions that I need to take? And then, you know, trying to actually come up with solutions and ways to work around those kind of revelations was interesting.
It also sounds like you're learning what some of your support systems might have been that you may not have acknowledged actually as support systems. I mean, and I use that in the most general sense of just like not even people, but just processes or things you do just to keep you going or keep you sane.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, and I think it is just like in that context, I used limits because it was like those support systems, I guess, are what prop up those things and extend those limits for me personally. And it's only by having removed them that then I actually see exactly where then I was falling short. But it's true like that. The other side of that coin is definitely like, what are the things that I'm doing that, you know, support me to make me a better person? I think that's a good lesson going forward is like, maybe I need more of those things even.
What do you think is the hardest thing that has been for you to adjust? Something that like what you realized this is actually really hard that you didn't think was going to be when it started? Or maybe life has been not too bad for you, Jared.
I was definitely very lucky with COVID, right? Like I didn't lose my job. I was in the city. It wasn't like I was super, super isolated. My social life didn't completely die off. So I guess that kind of how lucky I was too, right? Like that's a personal thing, you know? The privileges that I had definitely came out more forefront throughout this whole process too, for sure.
You got the vaccine early too, because you were in healthcare. That was
I did. Yeah, I did get the vaccine early because, well, I mean, we both did because we're both in healthcare. I mean, I think I would have been pushed to the front of the line because I do have that autoimmune disorder. So I get a lot of vaccines all the time because I'm trying to always prime myself. But yeah. So I think, yeah, both of those things then, you know, limits, privilege, those were pretty eye-opening as a direct consequence of COVID for sure. But enough about me. I want to dive into your personal revelations throughout this process too.
Maybe I'll start with some like kind of more like banal things, which was that working from home actually was great. Like I didn't realize that. So I remember when I took like the monitor home for the first time and just like working from home was just really hard for me. Cause I guess I always thought of myself as like a company man in the sense of that, you know, you go into the office, you put on the tie, you know, like you pack your lunch and like that gives you like order and stability. And it was a bit hard for me to work from home at first, but within like 2 weeks, I actually realized that working in isolation is how I work best. And I think it's because I love quiet spaces. I love listening to my own music, just being able to eat, you know, like a whole roast chicken by myself, like just no judgment, just like being my true self, you know, at home in the office. I'm a morning person, I found out. Like I actually like just rolling out of bed, making a tea, and then 15 minutes later, like firing up the emails and starting up the servers and things like that. So that's like one little thing I learned about me since the pandemic. And that's never going to change. Like now that I know this is the case, I'm partly for geographic reasons, which is that we moved to a city that has no data science jobs because we were banking on the assumption that I could work remotely. But just even if there's ever the option, I will always choose remote work. So that's one thing I learned. I think also from some personal finance stuff, because I mean, COVID, obviously, you think of it as kind of two main impacts. If there's the health impact, right? Millions of people died, many people got sick, but then there's also just all the huge financial dislocation. And on a personal finance level, what I learned is that I think I didn't appreciate going in just how important the idea of like cash flow was. Like whenever you read like business books and like, business people are always obsessed about cash flow. But as economists, not that economists don't think about cash flow, but it's much more of a focus on like net worth and net present value and your assets and your liabilities. And I think I was too concerned about those things and not thinking enough about like what are the ways that I generate cash flow, which for people like you and I is basically just our income that we earn. Basically, that's it. There's other ways, of course. You can, like, we know people who buy houses and then they generate cash flow from the rents they earn. But for you and I, it's mainly just our income. And similarly, obviously this is the hindsight is 2020. Let's say the next time we're in an ultra low interest rate environment, and there's an opportunity to borrow money for 10 years for 2%. Just do it. Like just borrow the money. Like it's like as long as you buy something that has like a reasonably stable value, like just imagine how just after 10 years, what inflation will be, what your income growth will be. It's just such a small thing compared to like whether or not, oh, you're paying an extra $200, $300 a month of interest. I think that's something I just didn't really think about, was that you should almost plan your life, not about like peak life. Lifetime asset income thing or whatever. There's that theory that Milton Friedman and The Economist came up with, but just really think about like what is your cash flow as a household going to look like over the next 5 to 10 years? I don't know if you've also had some kind of a similar revelation, given that we both bought houses and think about much probably. I don't know about you, but I've definitely been doing a lot more budgeting since COVID started in a way I didn't do before.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think for me, it wasn't really COVID, I think, that brought that on, though, right? I think if COVID hadn't happened and I just bought this house, by the way, listeners, I just bought a house, then I would have had that kind of motivation as well then anyway. But yeah, I totally agree. Like the cash flow issue is the main driver. I'm looking at the mortgage that I have and I'm like, I have the cash flow to keep paying off the mortgage. Historically, it's a very safe asset. So in the long run, it's going to appreciate. So I'm even of the opinion, like maybe in 5 year time when it's time to like renew the mortgage, why am I gonna keep paying it down? Can't I re-amortize? Like, why wouldn't I just hold on to this debt as long as possible? Because I'm paying way less interest than if I took that money and just bought some very conservative stocks that paid high dividend. It's a good point, I think, that you bring up about that cash flow and that I've been too afraid of debt, I guess. I think that's kind of a similar realization than maybe that you're having.
Yeah, but the a consequence of that could be that you, like one realizes that you're too afraid of debt. I don't know if that's the case for me. I think more just that the implication is that like, can you conservatively say your cash flow situation will be good from doing this? And that may lead you to take on more debt, but it may lead you to take on less debt too, potentially. Like different people can come to different conclusions. I think maybe for you and I, that was the case, but I think I'm happy, or actually, I wish we had taken on slightly l less debt. I think I just would have wanted it, or the amount of debt might have been fine. I just wish we had have done it for longer, and not just like, oh, we should have done it for longer because it turned out that was the right bet, but like, what's the reason behind it as well? And I think I have a new sense of the reason behind it. And like, if I was to go back, like, and I had this theory, like, it might also realize, like, maybe we should have bought a house that was in a less desirable, like a less pleasant location, but had like a guest suite in the sense of that, like that generates cash flow. Or maybe that would have let us take a larger mortgage based on this kind of cash flow idea. So it just would have opened up new ways of analyzing the world. It's too late now. Like you may, we've kind of, we're locked in at this point, reasonably. So I definitely think a lot differently about this. And also just that stocks been very volatile, even housing prices, very volatile. But the one thing that I realize is incredibly stable and I have a lot of control over is my job and my income. And I mean, of course, that's like an obvious thing. Well, like everyone gets it that, I mean, short of like your trust fund baby, like, Trudeau or Morneau or whoever, but like most people get like they have to work to get their income. But I was still too focused in like get stocks, get this, get that. And I just didn't realize enough about like there's actually a lot more control over the sort of jobs you can get and the income that you can earn from your career in a way that now I'm only just sort of realizing. And you maybe need to get to a certain level of seniority because, if you're just getting into a field, like you kind of just take what you can get because you can build up that capital. But once you have, I think, like maybe 5 years of work experience, you do have a lot of control over like the way you, the who you work for and the amount of money you can earn, although of course that comes with trade-offs. I'm not saying that this is like a free lunch. You can always just make more money with no trade-offs, but I don't think I appreciated that. And that kind of connects to my idea of like the cash flow. So like you can make decisions like, hey, I'm going to take a job. I don't really like working as much, but because this is like something that my wife will be going on mat leave, and actually then we'll be able to manage the cash flow of our household a lot better. And so I wish I had kind of thought about that before this whole pandemic started. And now we have this life lesson for the rest of our lives. So that's good. We're still fairly young.
Yeah. I wonder how, like, I think that might, or I worry, because we're both in a similar industry. How specific are these advantages and like this kind of thinking to the fact that we both have very high demand skills? Like, that's what I wonder, like, do people feel like they have that kind of flexibility?
Yeah.
And maybe is it an illusion that they don't, or are they actually right in that kind of evaluation? And maybe it's much more difficult in other
No, industries. You're totally right, Jared. I'm very much describing the strategies for people of like professional,
right,
middle-ish, upper middle-ish class background. So this podcast is not, it is definitely bringing those biases into the analysis for sure. I mean, it's always been the case, right? That even if, like, let's say you're on the lower end of the income earning spectrum, there's always ways you can earn more, right? Like you want to have like a nicer experience working normaler hours. You can work at a bookstore and the pay is lower. If you are willing to work night shifts in like a restaurant, then you'll get a higher salary. So there's always those compensating differentials, but yeah, the difference between $15 an hour versus $25 an hour might be a lot in percentage terms, but it might not, it's not that much in absolute terms. So yeah, it's not like, I'm not saying you can transform your life by doing the night shift to get a slightly higher salary kind of thing. We do want to get to like how our views about policies and politics have changed, but maybe I'll just table that for a later discussion about what this means in terms of income inequality and how kind of COVID has brought that out. But before we, you know, move off this topic, Jared, related, but with the benefit of hindsight, is there things you would have done differently going back to March 2020? And again, strategies as opposed to, I would have bought Bitcoin on this date and sold it on that one, because obviously we all know how to become a billionaire in retrospect.
I think mine is less about, like, I think we've talked about, you know, cash flow and making decisions about like support your working life. I think I kind of wish that I could have stepped back and like focused more on the local, done more and taken more out of my time. Let's spend time with the close friends. Let's spend time with the family. Let's do things for me versus so much time learning the nuances of the new variant of COVID that then just didn't necessarily make a big difference, right? Like having such intimate knowledge of the differences between, you know, that, what was it, even when the Delta wave was coming out, right? I don't think that that necessarily improved my life or like made any kind of tangible difference, but I've spent a lot of hours. And so I wish I could have been more present in my local world is how I wrote it down, as opposed to the global world. That would have mitigated, I guess, some of those lessons that I learned. And I think that's even the actions that I'll take in order to mitigate some of those limits that I've seen of myself hitting those like boundaries that told me, hey, Jared, yeah, stop reading so much global affairs. So I think that's what I would kind of like to have done differently.
So how was it that translated into lessening those connections with your friends? Just because like, there's only so much time in the day, or you just felt too bummed out to like,
I think it's more opportunity cost perspective. What am I remembering from the time of COVID? I should have just taken Jasmine out on more dates, right? You know, I should have just gone out and had more long chats with friends. You know, I didn't need to spend an evening reading the latest papers on the COVID genome. And I think that that would have been a better trade-off, and I would have had more, like I would have built more memories and more experiences that I could look back on fondly. And I mean, it's not like I was super alone or anything, right? I still had, you know, weekly Zoom calls. I mean, we were in like a podcast discussion reading group and whatever. So I just felt like, I think my balance ended up not, I could have benefited more if I had brought that local side up more, you know?
Yeah, I will say that one of the risks of the cash flow approach, though, is that then you don't do things like you don't go out on dates and you don't go traveling. I know that would be a risk for me.
Well, I think you can think of cheaper dates, Eric. Why not a date being like we go on a walk in the park, or we make a picnic, or
Yeah, okay, good
we go
point.
out and experience nature and we do free things, right? Now I've just
Just
moved
doing
to
things, yeah.
Hamilton. We're getting these flyers that are like, oh, what's going on in the city? Free events. And there was lots of that in Toronto. And I lived there for so long, but it felt unimportant or like lame or whatever. Maybe I should have just done those things.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. One thing though, I wish that Netta and I had have done more of though was travel. Like just like, and I know that it's really hard to do because like we started dating like maybe was that a year and a half before COVID happened. So like limited opportunities to do international travel together. But that's one thing that does make me sad when I think about it. Because like now we're gonna have a kid, it's just gonna be international travel's off the table for quite a while. So actually that is something with the benefit of hindsight I wish we had have done more of.
On a personal note, that is so that's a decision that Jasmine and I have been thinking about a lot too recently. Because in the near future, we do want to start trying to build a family, but we're trying to plan just a last Turkey trip and be like, I've always wanted to go to Istanbul personally because I think the history of the city is amazing. And so we're trying to plan that and like just take advantage of that. And then it's like, oh no, forever after that, we'll never go on a trip again. Though I have friends who've taken infants to like London, England, and that's like totally doable. So I think it's not too late either to say that you want to travel more with Netta. Like, just take the baby. Who cares?
Yeah, I think our plan though is like the first 12 months only car driving.
Yeah, that
Yeah,
might be pretty reasonable.
yeah, yeah. Once they're three or four, yeah, you can take them on a plane. I think that's a lot better. Yeah, all I mean to say is that like if you get too obsessed about personal finance strategies, you can become stingy to the detriment. You forget that the point of having a positive cash flow is so that you can do the things you like, not just to have a positive cash flow for the sake of it. Well, you have to have a positive cash flow. You can't finance a life permanently with a negative cash flow, but like obviously the value is so that you have that flexibility at some points in your life to do what you want.
Yeah, you're right. It's an easy thing to forget when you are trying to just maximize your income.
So going back, so we've got Jared took too much of a global view, was not enough in the moment during COVID. Do you think that that made you too risk averse? I'm curious because I see a lot of people even today, and I think this is maybe like a cultural divide. Obviously, it's correlated with political orientation, but there's a lot of people who you might be like, oh, they're kind of a little bit risk averse, kind of like maybe move on. Is it time to move on? Like, do you see that? Do you feel like you fell in like any sort of spectrum along those lines or?
I mean, I think on some of our later questions here, I was going to put in, I've become more risk averse, I think. Or I've realized that I or always was. Do I think I've became more risk averse? Sorry, maybe I'm misunderstanding. So because of my global perspective and that I think I was inundating myself too much with information, I was then potentially overestimating those risks. And that was then the danger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or not, you can either overestimate risks or you can not properly calibrate them with other relative risks, right? Like you may accurately understand the risk of the new variant, but you're forgetting that driving across the city is the most risky thing you can do, right? And not putting that in perspective.
Right, to compare it to other things. I think the overload of information actually helped me put it more in perspective because I was reading all of these papers so much. I was taking the time to compare that to like, well, what's the risk of like getting in a car accident? I guess like I came to the conclusion when we were in that like, the masking, it's such a low cost for me personally to wear a mask in terms of comfort and even just the cost of, because we like sewed our own reusable masks, and that was how we could mitigate the financial expenditure. Like, I think there was definitely alternatives that I could have spent locally that didn't have to be going to bars and clubs. I didn't do that before anyway. That's not really my scene. So to say that like that information was making me more risk averse, I don't think so. The reason that I was driven towards that was I think I had like an innate desire to understand and to fully grasp exactly what was happening. Some of that nuanced detail was too much and didn't really impact my life. And I could have just rolled with it a little bit more. I hope I didn't become too risk averse. I mean, I was gung ho with like the lockdowns when we didn't really know what the death rate of COVID was and when we weren't really sure about that. But already, I don't really wear a mask unless I'm in a healthcare setting or going to be around people that are very high risk. I go out, hang out with friends, but then I get vaccinated. And I think because we have really good treatments now and we have these vaccines, the risks of dying from COVID are quite manageable now. So I'm definitely not on the fit on the side of like, let's keep things locked down. Let's keep restrictions. Like, we can manage this through the healthcare setting now. I mean, that's a separate point where we need to actually get some money into healthcare, but it's definitely possible to manage it. So yeah, I don't think I've become too risk averse from that. What about you? I mean, you brought up the risk averse thing. Did you find yourself tipping into that trap?
No, not at all. I mean, if anything, I'm on the other side of the spectrum, I think. I think the question is like, there's something when I see people that are seem like overly risk averse, like it kind of bothers me. And I guess what I'm wondering is like, is that a fair, am I fair? Is it fair to do that? And I think like at a minimum is like, well, if it's just a private thing, right? Like if someone just wants to wear a mask, even let's just say that there was no medically necessary reason to wear a mask. You're not at all high risk. No one in the room is high risk. Like this, you're in like a fairly capacious room with good airflow, but they just want to wear one just for that feeling of security. Like, is that okay? I mean, it's okay in the sense of that, of course, we live in a free society. People should do whatever they want, but like, should there be like a social pressure to like kind of like chill out? It's going to be okay. I would say there could be if one thinks that like our society is becoming increasingly neurotic, especially about risks in general, the whole thing about kids can't have playgrounds, everything needs to be rubber padded, there's no sharp edges, blah, blah, blah. Kids can't walk around the block. Is that related to that kind of cultural movement? And if so, then it does seem to be fair to be like, look, guys, I'm sorry, but like on net, we know that systematically we are being overly concerned about risk. We need to take a little bit more risk. And but then this seems a bit of a tenuous link, to be honest, to whether or not someone wants to wear a mask, you know? So I think because it's so personal, I should just kind of like try to chill out a little bit more. And I'm totally okay with people wearing masks. To be clear, there are so many contexts where it's a great idea to wear a mask, like in any healthcare context, like I said, people, like you said, that are high risk or blah, blah, blah. But just this kind of like mask culture, this really strong emphasis on safety at all costs. I'm on the opposite side of that. Just instinctively, I recognize the benefits that come from taking risks and that you can definitely over insulate yourself. So yeah, I think for the question that I'm struggling with is like, am I being too aggressive in my desire to kind of move society onward and away from kind of COVID policies and restrictions? That's the kind of question I think I grapple with.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to elucidate why people do have such a high level of fear, because it could be a valid reason, such as maybe they just have a very high extreme value personally placed on safety or like on averting health risks, right? Even if there's no like medical induced reason for it, you know, they're on chemo or something. I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with someone like we're on a spectrum of having those values and those strengths and beliefs, right? I guess the problem for me is that like we have this like political arena where we're supposed to then settle those differences. And that's where then, you know, we have to do come up with like the mandates and whatever. And to me, it's then the like personal anger when it's not perfectly aligning with your own values and not understanding that it has to be. It's going to be a compromise. And the classic line of compromises is that no one is going to be happy if it's a true compromise. If I'm just going to touch base on what you've said, I'd like to see we push more in that political arena. And I think that that's like the place that we need to set up where we do push against those kind of ideas and set up like different viewpoints. But we do have to be kind of empathetic to people having those kind of opinions, I guess.
It's sort of like the challenge between like being a social critic versus treating people as individuals in the sense of that, like you might want to point out that, you know, why is it that there's such huge cross-sectional variation in, say, plastic surgery rates across countries? And why is it that the percent of people that have been getting plastic surgery may be going up or down over time across the country? Doesn't mean that any one individual, you should say, like, why are you getting plastic surgery? Like, this is a foolish idea. Like, you're denigrating your the sanctity of your body by doing this and creating this sort of weird arms race of like perfection of beauty. But that doesn't mean that one should also then close the door on making the obvious point that it doesn't make sense in, say, a country that, you know, where a third of women are getting plastic surgery. Like, I don't know if there's actually a country. I know like it's very high in some countries like South Korea and Brazil. I don't know if it's as high as a third, but just that, just as a social critic, that just doesn't make sense to me. That like that I should be able to point out that there's something kind of rotten there. And so similarly, you know, we could imagine a society where half the people walked around with masks at all time now, even though kind of COVID is just as lethal and potent as the average seasonal flu. Is as a social critic pointing out, can I point out and say like, well, like, why is there this change? It doesn't make sense because we weren't doing this 10 years ago when the flu was around every year, which it will be for the next millions of years. If you know, these viruses will stay with us for millions of years. And I think it's okay to point out that some of this over focus on safety is a sort of social neuroticism. Like it doesn't make sense on some level. Like, and that we lose a lot by doing that. But I'm very careful because when you abstract away from the macro down to the micro, you have individual circumstances, which, you know, everyone is in a very different place. So it's a very challenging thing to navigate, that like social criticism versus like individual support. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that's what I was trying to get across, but I think you put it way more succinctly, is like, what's the form of the communication? If you're talking to someone individually one-on-one, I don't think you can just start berating them for wearing a
Right.
mask because everybody
Right.
needs to be calm about it. But if the form is like, I'm writing a public blog about like, this is a bit on the extreme end, and we're putting that into the public sphere, then I think that that's an okay form for it. The one thing that has been concerning to me is the level of anger that those kind of comments now start to generate, because people start to take those blah comments that are out to the talk about society in general, and they take them personally, right? Well, I'm personally wearing a mask because I'm afraid and I would like to stay healthy. Oh, you're calling me an idiot, right? When it's like, no, I don't think that that's, I don't, I think you should be able to say that without people taking it personally, but then that's very hard. I don't know.
It is, I think it is very hard though to like treat people's individuals with, while also like having a generic view that on average people are doing something wrong. Either way, I think it's hard to do. I remember one time during the pandemic, like early on, like when masking was definitely very important to do. Maybe I had gotten the first vaccine at this point or not, and I was walking on to York campus. There was like some like Shoppers Drug Mart there or something, and like this woman like started like a like trying to wave me down and signal me. I'm like, what is this? What's she up to? Like an older woman, and she's like, COVID doesn't transmit from the air. You don't need your mask on. I didn't actually have my mask on. I had it down on like my chin because I kept going in and out of rooms, so it's just easier just to kind of have your mask down on your chin and then just like kind of pop it up and down. But I was like, well, first of all, lady, you completely. Obviously, you can't tell from where you're at. Like, I wasn't even wearing a mask. I agree. It might have been a bit silly if I was wearing a mask outside, but like, what is it your business? Like, why would you care so much? That person is emblematic of what I don't want to happen, right? Like, that's exactly like that inability to like separate social criticism from your ability to treat people as individuals. And she also happened to be wrong, but that's exactly what would happen when you do this, right? Which is you completely misread the situation.
Yeah, that's true. I agree. I mean, I think that's kind of, it's like the flip side of like, because I see where she's coming from of like trying to be perfectly correct. I don't know. And I think sometimes people twist that into thinking that you're helping a stranger by like pointing things out to them like that, or they think that they're doing it friendly, but they're really just coming off as obnoxious. It's a really tricky line to cross. You kind of have to have a personal relationship with someone to be able to ease into some kind of criticism like that if you're actually talking about someone's behavior.
But Jared, related to these conversations, how do you think your political views have changed in the last 3 years?
I think actually my views on political changes, and I don't know if this is right, because I would say that the biggest change has been on like an intuitive level for me. I think I'm much more likely to trust that a politician is actually trying to act in the way that they believe their constituents is voting for them. And I'm now much more likely to believe that there actually is some signal from the group of people that is making them, that wants them to act stupid. And this kind of started with Donald Trump, but then I think now seeing it with like politicians in Canada, like what was happening with Doug Ford, I guess. He recently just backpedaled on the CUPE fight that he stood up against, right? Where he was then going to use the notwithstanding clause to force them back to work. But then there was a very strong public signal, and then he completely backed off. So to me, I'm now starting to think like, there are these obvious cases that are coming out where like public sentiment is like completely 180ing these politicians. So now I think my intuitive sense is like these politicians, they're doing something stupid that I don't agree with, but it's probably because I don't agree with what the most people or what their voter incentives want. I guess that's kind of done two things to me. And this is because of COVID, one of like seeing how, public opinion can sway so much, and sometimes stupid things become very popular. And so my belief in like individuals building up to make a good decision has definitely been shattered. Then I guess my faith in democracy doing what it's designed to do has increased, but my skepticism that democracy doing what designed to do is good has decreased. I'm now more resonating with Churchill's. I don't know if this is Churchill's. I'm going to throw out a fake quote here, potentially. Democracy is the worst system except for all the other ones, because I'm not really sure how else to set it up except for, these swings of like public opinion that sometimes are just like grossly incompetent. And that's kind of unfortunate. So I guess that's maybe on like a macro sense how my politics have kind of changed. I don't know if it's really changing my voting, but definitely when I interpret a situation, that's how it's kind of changed.
So two questions to that. So one, wouldn't that make you more technocratic than you were before? So do you feel like you are just, we can either think of it like the political compass or just like a one-dimensional spectrum? Like, have you, do you feel like you've shifted in coordinate space, either on the political compass or on the 1D spectrum?
I think maybe that's made me less likely to vote for, I would say fringe candidates, but I wasn't really likely to vote for them before anyway.
Maybe parties that have associations with fringe candidates. Would that be fair?
To be less likely to vote for those types of parties?
Yeah. Like,
Yeah,
even if the
maybe.
leader isn't fringe, but they have some fringy people around them.
I don't think this is COVID related, but I've been trying to vote more and more for my local MP versus the party platform and trying to take that more and more into my consideration. For sure, like that's going to be an impact in that way. I think with my personal beliefs of like a balance between we need price signals for markets to work efficiently, but also markets, I think, are very unstable. And so we need some kind of government regulation in order to impact that, in order to control markets to keep them free. I was kind of already voting in that direction before. So that's maybe where I'm still going to keep voting. But I want to see the details too before I vote for somebody. And I guess actually, so if we go back to the conservative leadership debate, one of the knocks against Pierre that I didn't like was that I found his ideas to be detail light, which I think is a classic strategy because as soon as you start giving details, one of those details is going to piss somebody off. And that's what you don't want to do. Then I was like, well, how do I trust you're actually going to do any of the things that you're going to do? And, oh, I hate inflation. Well, that really matters on how you're actually going to tackle inflation, right? I really want to know the nitty-gritty of what you're going to do. I ended up not voting for him. I voted for Charest. A lot of people hate that because he just had more specifics about what he was going to do, I felt, and I wanted to reward that. If we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of voting, I like details now more than I did before, I think.
So you're very much not a, I like the vibes you're giving off, that you're not a vibes guy.
The details give me the vibes. That's how I get my vibes.
Like the thing that you could say generously about Pierre Poilievre is that he has excellently diagnosed the condition of the patient. He just hasn't offered any medical remedies, right? Like that would be the, right.
Which to me is like, I'm not electing you to tell me what's wrong with my life. I'm electing you to fix it. So
But
that's why I need those details now.
is it kind of weird? Well, obviously the government in power wouldn't want to diagnose your life in a way that made it seem like their rule was bad for you. But it just seems weird that like so few opposition parties do such a good job at that, because why wouldn't you highlight the struggles that people are having in a more effective way? I just like Pierre is just so good at doing that, and I'm surprised more people don't get a sense of like outrage when things are tough. Like the way like Bernie Sanders was very good at that too. He did that very well, and it's a way like it's almost like the cynical reading or maybe the Poilievre reading of the situation is like, well, that's because the elites are all part of the same team, right? And they don't want to rock the boat, so they're all it's all gloves on for them because they don't want to actually deal any knockout blows because they're all part of the same corrupt establishment. That's obviously absurd on many levels, but like that would be the a more of a fringe take on why there's less umbrage taken by opposition leaders on from like a personal perspective of like this is how your life is terrible right now.
All right. Well, so that's where I think my revelation of my or my faith is in politicians actually seeing what their constituents want. So I think Pierre Poilievre has really resonated with a certain subsection that happens to be large enough within the Conservative Party that is actually kind of accurately diagnosing that kind of section of where people are feeling it. Because like Jagmeet Singh says a lot of things about how inflation or like cash flow problems or like you can't make ends meet, those are all really diagnosing the same thing of that money is tight. And Jagmeet Singh is hitting on that problem all the time too. But his messaging doesn't resonate with conservatives because he's saying we need to tax the wealthy and we need to give people the money they need to actually get the things they need. And he says, you know, inflation is actually just like a corporate cash grab, which there are probably, and I'm not exposed to them, probably is the issue. NDP voters, and I guess this is where this intuition that I have, because I don't necessarily have huge swaths of poll data. I think Jagmeet Singh is speaking to a highly motivated section of the NDP party that really believes those things. And that's the issues that they're having, and that's how they see it. And he's probably connecting with those people. It just so happens that I remember the latest poll from 338 Canada was like they're at 21%. That's, you know, a rough estimate of where it'll then actually resonate. So I think all of them kind of are actually seeing that that's the issue. Maybe I'm out to lunch though. You got complaints about how I'm seeing it?
Well, it's more just like the word resonate, I think, is key there because, you know, you can say corporations are making more money than ever. And like Jagmeet Singh does tie that to, you know, just talking about like price gouging in a way, but it is partly effective, but it just doesn't resonate with people. Like when Pierre talks about you're in your 30s and you're living in your parents' basement, like it makes it very personal, right? Like Jagmeet Singh is so abstract, right? There are these big corporations and there are big profits. And like, and then by the way, I should say, I saw a speech that Jagmeet Singh gave recently and I thought it was very good. And again, because I think it felt more like a Polyev speech. So, but for the most part, this is kind of new. And one thing I guess I'm a bit surprised about, I think this is one of the things you, one topic you want to talk about, Jared, is what are things that we're surprised about that haven't changed since the pandemic? And I'm just surprised how badly the political left has done on capitalizing on this moment. Like they have done very poor in almost every country. And that would be surprising if you said there was going to be a public health crisis and a huge economic dislocation, but they're going to do really badly, even though there's going to be a lot of income inequality and wealth inequality generated over this period. A bit surprising, right?
Yeah, they just weren't able to really kind of muster that kind of anger. I mean, they're in power, though. How much is it that they are not able to capitalize it or that they're in a position of responsibility so they're easy to blame? We kind of have had a bit of a swing towards left-wing governments more recently, right? Like Biden got back in, Trudeau's
Yeah,
been in
but
power, Jacinda Ardern.
if I could just clarify
Yeah.
though, I don't mean like Biden or Trudeau, who you could say are like arguably on the left. I mean like the left in the same way that the far right has politically benefited, right? Like people like the far right has had a resurgence, but I mean talking about whatever country you think of. So in some countries like Canada, there actually is a party to the left of the liberals that have not at all benefited. In the United States, the progressive caucus within the Democrats have basically been completely sidelined. In fact, it's been taken over. Like the power players are your Joe Manchins and your Sinemas. I don't know the exact details, but basically it's the centrist Democrats that are driving the agenda. In France, like Macron, kind of more like a Trudeau. Again, there are socialists to the left of Macron, who, and they got destroyed in the election. The UK has been conservative after conservative government. Germany, yes, the Green Party is in coalition, but it's in coalition with the Conservative Party, right?
No,
And
no,
in.
no, no. The SDP is more center left than it was the
Okay.
Christian Democratic Union that was more center right.
Okay. In Sweden, like the far, in Sweden and Finland, it's the far right parties that have seen the electoral gains. Like, I just like. I'm just not seeing a lot of like left parties that have done particularly well in the last 3 years.
Yeah, but couldn't that also be a consequence? Right. So, like, why do the centrists have power in the US? And I think then why have the right, like, why did the right not be able to take back the midterms? Because centrists have been fleeing the Republican Party. And then, you know, the only alternative they have is they go to the Democrats. And so then now the those extreme leftists who really wanted to control the party are getting swamped by more and more people that are centrists that are then also voting with them, right? If there was a first mover advantage to the far right versus the far left, then don't you think that the wave of people fleeing the far right to the left is what's then also dampening any kind of far left momentum?
Okay, you're saying is that like if you're kind of a left-wing party, you're center-left party, you could either get more votes by appealing to people to the left of you, or you have this new influx of effectively right-wing immigrants to your party. Yeah,
Exactly.
that's fair. That's fair. I mean, but I guess my con this sort of line of questioning is not me like diagnosing the reason. It's just something I would have expected. Like if you just had asked me at the beginning, you had explained the facts of what would happen in the next couple of years, I would have just probably naively predicted that the left would be the big winners. And I also taken to your point that we should maybe wait for the next 3 or 5 years to see how much maybe we need a little bit more time for that to play out. But
Yeah.
anyways, at least there has been quite a resurgence in the right, like just their infrastructure, their communications, their media, their conspiracies that have like penetrated throughout society, fringe parties getting elected, or at least being viable.
I definitely agree with you that there is this dichotomy between the resurgent far right and the resurgent and like the far left.
So, Jared, what are some things that you expected to have happened that haven't come to fruition?
Yeah, I think actually when I was thinking of that question, I was thinking it more on a personal level. Like, I think to me, the beliefs that were tested was like, how much restrictions am I willing to take in order to give people that sense of safety? Like, I don't think that there's anything wrong with having been against some of them and thinking that it went too far with the lockdowns. But at the end of the day, when they were coming out, I was pretty pro them and I wasn't unwilling to stop going to bars and wear masks and get vaccinated and all those things, because I guess that elucidated to me my kind of belief in people's being able to have that kind of level of safety and being able to have that safety from COVID. And I think that also kind of did elucidate to me. I mean, you raised it earlier in the podcast where you're like, well, why weren't we doing all these lockdowns with the flu? And part of me, when I was like, yeah, why weren't we doing all those lockdowns with the flu? I think we should have been doing all that. And like, so many people die to the flu all the time. Why aren't we pushing vaccines more? Why aren't we, wearing masks in healthcare settings more when it was flu season? Like, there's a lot of people that died all the time, and we just knew how to prevent that, and we never did.
We know how to prevent deaths on the road. Just we ban automobiles or set the speed limit at
Exactly.
5 kilometers an hour.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And I think I would be in favor of those things too, right? Like lower speed limits, I'm quite a staunch urbanist. I'd love to see more walking, more biking, less cars, in general.
But Jared, this goes back to that issue though that I mentioned before of that being overly focused on the cash flow and forgetting the point of the cash flow is to have a good life. When the same thing like the point of public policy is to have on net like people enjoying themselves. So death is the you have to accept some amount of death to have life, right? Like
Yeah, but well, okay. So, like, if we're going to take the urbanist perspective, I mean, I would much rather walk to the grocery store with my little granny cart than actually drive way miles down in order to like buy things,
so the difference is that I'm talking about you have to pick a point on the frontier, and you're saying you want to change the frontier. And I'm all in favor of that, Jared. I'm saying if we can draw a new death life trade-off curve where everyone gets to walk, and so we just have a fundamentally less of a challenging trade-off to make. I'm all on board for that. I'm an urbanist too, but I'm just saying is like just given the trade-offs that you have to make today, I'm kind of surprised that you are willing to like sacrifice all the benefits that come from being people able to travel or people able to socialize just to prevent some number of what would be predictable deaths. I feel like that's a kind of a decision that we've accepted. It is just how human society
Well,
functions,
but
right?
like, I guess how much did it really impact things, right? Like, if you're wearing a mask and you're having a conversation with somebody at a bar, or then you're going to have to do it outside, like, that seems like a very small thing to give up.
Okay, yeah. So, and I agree, but I don't want it to be like a Mott and Bailey thing because like there are the truly disastrous. Well, this is let's talk about stuff that we've learned, like school closures, which
Yeah,
have
right.
I'm sure reduced some. No, they have I'm sure reduced the spread of COVID. By definition, you have fewer people in a room, assuming that they're not then having a meet up somewhere else. But like that, the cost of that have been tremendous. So like I agree, there must be a spectrum of like for a given amount of human interaction, if it's at a bar versus if it's at like a place of learning, we want to prioritize some of them over the others, right?
Yeah, for sure. And that's why, yeah, I think I would have been against closing the schools. Or, and I mean, in the very early part, I wasn't against closing schools because I didn't have an accurate sense of the risk. And so that was out of an abundance of caution. Now, I don't think since since they came out with the vaccine, I don't think the schools should have ever really been closed again, because that's what I'm saying. And like, where are things that, you know, the choices are actually butting up against your values, and where I do value that education and giving those kids the ability to learn. And so that's where I guess that butting up against life and education, I didn't budge in my sense of like where I think education is important. And so then that wouldn't have changed. And so I wouldn't have wanted to change that. Another way that we could have prevented COVID getting in or more of that is like, let's close the borders, right? Let's prevent all air travel. And that was something that I always thought was also something that I wouldn't have been willing to give up, because I do believe in more of a pluralistic society, and like bringing people from different cultures and different nations is beneficial on the whole. That's where the choices, like, you know, I had that value, and we know like that benefit for like preventing disease spread and bringing other things in, but that's where my values held firm. And I guess that's where I thought COVID kind of elucidated truth about myself, was when there was like one value that I have butting up another, and then which one ended up being chosen, and where did I think that changes should not happen? I guess that's what I was trying to get at with that question. And then what my answer would have been, yeah, pluralism, education, but then, you know, the things that I was willing to give up of like masking and like recreational large gatherings without that kind of precaution, right? I guess that's where I thought that it was kind of elucidating. Another main topic that we've talked a lot about on the podcast is economics. COVID has obviously impacted everything about life. So I wonder how you have your views changed on economics then, Eric?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's kind of hardened a lot of views I've had before. So like maybe a little bit more on the extreme end. So like I was always kind of a foreign policy hawk. I think I've become even more so, if that was possible. Like I've become even more critical and concerned about CCP and Russia's influence, for example, in the West.
Yeah. So that's not just COVID, but that's even just recent events over the past 3 years, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So this is the time since COVID. Although, but let's pause to remember that this is like the only recent pandemic in history which we're not allowed to basically investigate its origins, because the CCP is blocking any, I mean, like literally this disease that's killed 15 million people, whether or not it was like a pangolin to human transmission or a lab leak on for either would be like extremely important to know. Either of those would be very valuable, whether it's like the biosafety risks of wet markets or just the significant rethink we would need about like virology research. And that has been because of the People's Republic of China. And we just, and that the fact that that's almost not brought up every other day, it's kind of a little bit crazy, because you're kind of just so used to it now. It's like, oh yeah, I mean, yeah, kind of covered up. We don't really know how it started, but I guess it's not that important. It's crazy important, right?
Yeah, no, you're right. Actually, that's like a huge, massive loss of life. And like, you would think that like that's for the benefit of everyone, but yeah, they're just so afraid of losing face.
I think I've become more, obviously, like the whole housing thing has become pretty grotesque, just the public policy, kind of a joke, right? So that's kind of more of the same. I've actually become more in favor of a flat income tax. Again, just that thing of that, like, the more you kind of lock people out of being able to build wealth through housing, I think it's good public policy anyway, just to favor people working as opposed to earning income through basically non-working effectively through the ownership of assets. So in favor of lowering income taxes, raising capital gains, and possibly consumption taxes, but I don't like the way that would be regressive. I know that there's ways of having progressive consumption tax. I don't really understand the technical details, so I don't want to comment on it. This is controversial. I've also become more in favor of privatizing healthcare within Canada. I just think that the single payer systems have been really bad throughout the world, like uniquely bad. So like New Zealand, the UK, and Canada, every healthcare system has gone under a lot of strain, but now you could say, well, that's a correlation, but I think the causation is that like it's just really hard in single payer systems to have that connection between taxes you pay and benefits you get. So it's like taxes aren't earmarked. I mean, there's a few exceptions, right? Like, you know, CPP is kind of like an earmarked tax, but for the most part, taxes are general revenue. And so like it's really hard to convince people to pay more taxes and then say, yeah, I know, but like we'll invest in a bunch of things, some of which will be the healthcare system, and eventually you'll see the benefit of that. I agree with the critique of the left that the problem is that healthcare is underfunded. It is underfunded. Okay, there's also a lot of inefficiencies, but I also do think it's just generically underfunded. But a way to create funding for something is for people to pay for it when they receive the service because it makes sense to them. It makes sense that, oh, I'm going to pay for this cataract, like whether it's through insurance or out of pocket, because I'm really seeing that benefit. And so you're basically funding the healthcare system directly. So I've come to the view that I think that might be necessary for Canada. And Ontario is actually taking that. So this is very much like recent news stories in Ontario. And I'm tying those thoughts I've had together to like come to the conclusion that like I'm on board for this if eventually we get to the point where we get more of an infusion through this mechanism.
I worry about the opening them up of the privatization just because of the inequalities that it can potentially spur. And then I also see it as a slippery slope of like, the people who can afford to pay for healthcare, they will stop supporting the public system. And so then now you lose a huge voter base. A lot of people are no longer incentivized in order to pressure the government to fix it. So to me, I worry about the knock-on effects on that. When you talk about, yeah, like making it auditable like that. We can make laws and we can change the government how we want. Let's just hamstring them and force, these certain tax revenue streams to be healthcare funding. We can make that a policy and we can put that forward. I guess the problem is finding the public support enough to get a party that would see their own benefit in following that is difficult.
This is where what I'm making a claim here is an empirical one, not a theoretical one. Like everything you've just said are all completely reasonable ideas that have either been true in the past or could be true in the future or in other contexts would be true. Again, the idea that you will create inequality, but this idea that, we can just spend more on healthcare and that there'll be a political party that will capitalize on that. I'm just saying that it hasn't happened. And the claim that, well, it has, like, Doug Ford has deliberately defunded the healthcare system so it would get to a crisis point, so then he could privatize it. It's like, okay, let's say that that is true. How can that explain how a socialist or a social democratic party in British Columbia with extremely high political support has the worst, like one of the worst healthcare crises outside of the Atlantic provinces? It's worse than Ontario and BC right now. And like, if the NDP in power in BC can't solve this problem, I'm just coming to the conclusion that I just don't think it's going to be solved. And we need to look at other alternatives because the theories of what could have fixed it are just not being borne out,
Right. With healthcare, I am at this kind of hopelessness level where I don't see a perfect solution or one that seems even acceptable enough. It's very frustrating.
What could be an interesting experiment, though, is that if Ontario goes down a more of a privatized route and BC sticks with the Medicare model, and then we can actually then have a comparison to see what happens.
As soon as we have the diverging provinces, that should make like a difference, hopefully.
One of the other things too, a bit of a change, but this is more of like I feel like I've become more conservative, but I like conservative parties less. That's very accurate. Like I think I'm much less likely to vote for a conservative party, but I consider myself a lot more conservative than I was 3 years ago, which is interesting. And one of the way that kind of grumpy conservatism I feel has manifested myself is like an even if this was such if it was possible, even more cynical and dismissive takes on what I see as like virtue signaling movements within
Oh,
like
yeah.
the government and corporations, like ESG and EDI. And I think it would be very hard for me to like sign up for something that I felt was a complete cynical ploy because I think of them as like net negative distractions if they're not like really actually sincere, which there are definitely some not-for-profit groups where they are quite sincere. Like I'm thinking of like, Netta's work and say like harm reduction or another place she's worked. I think that those people are actually committed to like an idea of equity, diversity, and inclusion. I'm pretty skeptical that like, the Ministry of Transportation is. I just don't think that's the case, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. I think that might be just an aging thing, though. I don't know. I mean, COVID might have accelerated it too, but I feel a similar thing. And I think that's kind of reflected in the idea that I had before where I'm like, I want to know the details, right? I don't care about you telling me that you're gonna prevent overdoses. Tell me how you're gonna do it. And then I will judge if I think that that will actually have the effect that I want. I totally agree. I think that's like a super common thing, or I hope it's a very common thing. It might even be a good thing that people are more like that too. Hopefully, we can get real things done. Damn it.
Yeah. The flip side of that, though, not that you're anywhere near this, but like, I mean, I know these circles, like, just so much of like conservative movements, 90% of their brain power is spent like owning the libs, right? It's
Yeah.
like there's a whole industry of creating like anti-woke output, which is also just completely useless. It has
Which
no,
is also
again,
just virtue signaling. Yeah.
it's just also virtue signaling in a different way.
It's hilarious. It's the same thing that they're trying to, that they complain about the left and that they own them for the most, is the exact same thing that they're doing.
I one thing too, now having worked in like the private sector for about a year, is that I feel like I'm less likely to want to come back to the public sector, which, you know, for me, I've always, like, my parents were civil servants. Like, I've worked for government or quasi-government institutions, and I feel like a natural home there. And I think, like, going forward in my life, I'm just, it will be harder for me to do that. And I think some of the reason is just that, like, the civil service in Canada has not been able to perform at a very high level. And it would be nice if we could actually move towards more of a, like, there's models in other countries where there's, you know, the annual, like, elite civil service exams, like in Singapore and things like that. And I think, like, it just seems like there's an increasing divide between, like, the exciting things that are happening in the private sector, and just more and more departments or groups that are government or quasi-government are feeling a lot more like the like Service Ontario.
I totally agree. The ineptitude of government in a lot of Western countries, it's not necessary. There's so many governments that have efficient bureaucrats. I would love to see wages go up, but I also want to see people being able to be let go easier so that we actually can spur people to rise to the jobs that we want them to fill, but compensate them far more for that too.
So, Jared, do you have other things about politics or economics that you've changed your views on in the last 3 years?
I think, as far as economics goes, and this kind of ties into that recognition of privilege that I've certainly had on a personal level, is that I think, like, we need to do more to give people the freedom to have freedom. Like, there's a certain amount of wealth that you need to have in order to be able to actually become a productive member of society. And the safeguards that we have now barely help people scrape by. And that does not allow them to actually improve. And personally, I think that maybe part of the big productivity stagnation that we've had in the West a lot is that we don't give the individuals the resources to actually try and improve themselves because all of our supports are so focused on getting them the bare necessities. You need free markets and you need those prices, but you need people to have the basic resources in order to participate. And that's another pillar that we need to have in order to be able to actually be a capitalist society.
I definitely don't disagree with that. I worry, though, that the limiting factor has become less and less like your initial endowment, and speaking in like an economics model here, and more just the barriers to entry, whether that's cultural or just like regulatory. I guess I'm more concerned that it's just it, like, let me give an example. There are some states now in the United States, I think Maryland and Oregon recently, where they're actually just removing requirements of college degrees for government positions, just as like the default. It, like, the job didn't make, like, why would you need an undergraduate degree to be like an administrative assistant for the whatever, the city department or something? It doesn't make sense, right? And so there are things like that, like you're creating these like artificial barriers to entry. But then, by the way, like, you can tie that into like systemic racism, in the sense of that if your viewpoint is like, why are there systematically different outcomes for people? It's like, well, because like there's more and more barriers to jump through, and if you don't have that endowment and like the societal capital and support, you're just not going to be able to like get the perfect grades and go to the universities and nail the job interview and know how to network on LinkedIn and all that jazz. And so I think the more things we can do to like reduce those barriers, like building permits, for example, like whatever, like, or, you know, or licensing requirements, all those sorts of things, I think could complement what you're saying.
Oh, for sure. I think that's the same goal, achieved through the opposite side of the coin. Because I think then too, remove the college degree, but you also need the computer skills. So how are we making computers available for people who don't have the capital to access that? Because that's an important part of it. People need to know Excel for so many jobs. People need to know how to use Zoom. And I think there's a lot of people that don't have that access to that. But I do also think you're absolutely right, and you've hit the nail on the head. There are also all these restrictions where people need more than is necessary. And both of those things, to give people that freedom, need to kind of meet in the middle. It needs kind of both.
Yeah, no, that's well put.
I guess we're coming down to something fairly specific, I guess, now. And that's and really, really relevant to COVID is public health agencies and public health guidelines. I'd like to start it off, I guess, in that I think before this, I didn't really think about it all that much. And, you know, what's really impacted me working in healthcare and especially the research-oriented discovery side has really elucidated to me the difficulties of setting these guidelines, the level of uncertainty, the unbelievable amount of evidence that you need to have, the problems in the scientific process that need to be overcome, which I think it does in the long run, but COVID happens and you don't have time to wait. To me, throughout all of this, Fauci was a charismatic guy, the guy at the right time in the right place. I unfortunately probably listened to him more than I did the Canadian counterparts, but I had a lot of sympathy for him when he was in those roles because I kind of had that backdoor view into what does the evidence really look like? What are the, you know, restrictions on what you can actually know and how difficult of a task this is? And so when he was ultra conservative on things, or then even right, like making the mistakes about, well, we don't want the general public to have masks because we need to protect our frontline workers, I was very sympathetic and I guess very understanding about those pivots, even though I know that generated a lot of anger. So to me, I guess the biggest change in my views is like, we don't need to just disseminate what the actual guideline is, but how do we disseminate the process and the reasoning behind those guidelines, right? Because I think why was I so sympathetic to Fauci was because I could understand how he's trying to weigh this balance between the people that are actually working in those healthcare situations. The fact that, you know, it takes time for the world to ramp up mask production, and the fact that it's very uncertain about how effective the transmission was from airborne and how effective masks would be in the general public when we didn't have any studies really on untrained use for masks and how, and it's still kind of not entirely pinned down the exact size of the effect. So to me, how do we actually incorporate that into public health agencies and into those guidelines so that people can see that nuanced view? And how do we prevent, you know, that becoming an information overload? Because, you know, the more nuanced you get, the less people are going to even pay attention because it's just too much, right? They're not going to read a novel when it comes to how to protect yourself from the flu every year. I guess that's where the main thrust of my views have been, the largest deltas there.
That is aligned with what you kind of said earlier, which is your, or my interpretation of what you said earlier, which is you're kind of more of a technocrat. You have more sympathy with the technocrats.
Yeah, for sure.
Before I give my thoughts on that, do you have the same feeling for like central bank governors around the world in the same
Yeah, I think
position?
so. I mean, even through this, we can see raising interest rates having been an issue and having been a problem, but also inflation has been an issue. I think it's really hard to look at the counterfactual and see if it would have been that much better than the route that we've been going on. As much as maybe I personally would have liked Tiff Macklem to move faster, interest rates haven't had to go up to like something astronomical, and we haven't seen a complete collapse of all society either. So, and it seems like interest, like inflation is starting to maybe come down. I say hesitantly. I think I'm fairly sympathetic to the fact that these are huge decisions with not a lot of certainties that they're having to make here. And there's going to be a lot of public backlash to them too.
Yeah, I have a very different view, I think, than you. I don't know how different it is, but
Fair
it's
enough.
different. The first thing I find frustrating about these technocratic institutions is just the lack of acknowledgement of uncertainty that there is.
Well, but isn't that exactly what I said, where we need more of that nuance and more of that, like how they're making that decision process to come forward?
Sure. Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm concerned that decisions and outcomes have been worse because of the need to preserve this air of infallibility is too strong of a word, but basically like we are the experts and we're the smartest people in the room. Okay, so I do agree with you what you said there about the nuance in the sense of that like you need to be able to link your actions to a target. So like we're doing this to prevent, you know, keep getting like down to 2% in the long run or blah blah blah. So I guess I worry that like institutional reputation, their perspective on their institutional reputation and career is leading to suboptimal decision making. Okay, so that's point number one. So I guess I'm just less sympathetic to them. I see them like anyone. I'm not saying I would be any different in this situation. I'm talking about from like an optimal social planning perspective here, which no one has when they're actually in that position. The second thing I is just unlike macroeconomics, the biggest shame about the whole COVID era was how few high quality randomized control trials or studies were actually done. This is nothing new. For people like myself who have like gnashed our teeth at just the poor quality of how we gather data for like clinical trials and everything like that, it's all over again. And I will just go from start to end. So we started with the COVID and like we have no idea what transmission is. So what we'll do is we'll report this like observational data of people that kind of come forward with like flu symptoms. It's like, well, that's not representative of the population at all. Like, how hard would it have been for public health agencies to have just randomly, like, just done random sampling? Now, of course, you have a problem about some people aren't going to open your door, and then that, like, is a bias, but, like, just such low-hanging fruit, like, no playbook for how to gather data. And then once we're actually in the full swing of the pandemic, sure, okay, good trials on the first vaccine. Excellent. That was high-quality data, unambiguous, like, the serious mortality or hospitalization rates was just like was like 90% lower, 95. It was just obvious, so powerful. And then everything else became crappier and crappier. So like the point of like the bivalent booster shots, like based off of basically animal models. Like I haven't kept full track of it, but I've noticed the deteriorating quality of like the approval process for like boosters and just like we don't need to run these trials anymore. Like, oh, there's some observational data from Israel. Like that's good enough for us. Like total crap. And the thing about masking, again, not a single RCT of masking in North America. I mean, that's crazy, right? That's crazy. It's like there's this idea that like, well, at a certain point, enough observational data is enough. Like, no, like actually literally a randomized controlled trial of 100 people would have been more valuable than 3 years of observational data. I mean, actually 50, 25, I like it could have literally been an absurdly small amount. And I just all of the mistakes we make about gathering like real inferential statistics on these crises was just such a tragedy in my view. In the same way we have no idea how COVID started and we're never going to know. We have no idea how effective masking is and we're never going to know. There's like some random studies carried out in like villages in Bangladesh. That's apparently the only place on planet Earth that was worth like carrying out a trial for something. It's just crazy to me. I don't know. So I feel like public health agencies need to adopt a playbook on like this is how we gather data in an actual way that will let us make informed decision making here. Or sometimes it gets really hard. Like how I don't know how you would design a trial to determine like the spread of COVID of say shutting down bars versus shutting down grocery stores. That's like there's limits there. I don't think you can do that. But there are so many other things that we just didn't do. So I guess I'm a bit depressed about that. And I feel like I therefore I have a little less respect for those sort of agencies that they haven't taken causality serious enough in understanding data throughout the crisis.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I wish we had the infrastructure to kind of do that. I think the problem is that in normal times, we as a society have not put that to the forefront of what's important. And these guidelines and these government agencies, I don't think they've had enough drive to really, we're going to make the studies that's going to guarantee that we know the definite answer. It's more like, well, there's all this funding out there. It's much cheaper. Just put it all in a meta study and just figure it out. That'll be cheaper and we don't have to hire more people. I think there's that big issue of like not valuing accuracy because we don't want to pay for it. That's the one issue. Then this one is maybe a bit more complicated, but it's like, how do you morally set up some of those RCT trials when it's like, with the masking? Okay, maybe we have some observational data already that the masking might help. And we know in hospital settings, we have the RCTs that the masking really helps to prevent more infectious things like tuberculosis or whatever. Who's the city that we're going to have to say, nope, don't sell any masks there? Like, it's not going to be that big of an effect size, but like, isn't that what we're going to need to do in order to get a real random control trial? We'll need to randomly pick different locations or different individuals and actually then give them the masks and or prevent them.
No, so this I can actually answer this question. So the way this is done in studies where you can't actually ethically compel someone to do or to not do something is you just do an intention to treat model where the control group or the test group, whatever we want to think about it, is the one that is encouraged not to do it. So like basically you just literally have the people say like, we're running a trial. We'd really like you not to eat carbohydrates in the next month. And like that's literally all you need to do. We're gonna give you, oh, you give them some resources. You say like, here's some diet books or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And like literally doesn't mean that everyone in that group didn't eat carbohydrates. But if you can actually still detect a signal from just encouraging people to do something, so it's like the fact that the effect actually the effect size is almost always conservative, assuming you don't have like p hacking or publication bias. But like the same thing could be done here. Like, look, guys, like there's no evidence that masks work. We just really like you just to like not wear one. Here's some guidelines on like how you can stay safe in these sort of situations. Boom, do run the trial. If you detect something, if you don't detect something, it doesn't mean that for sure masking is ineffective. But if you detect a significant benefit from the group that was told to mask compared to the group that was told not to mask, then you for sure know that masking is useful, right?
Right. I guess that's true as a way to get around it. I mean, I think I did see maybe that is a study that you were talking about. I don't remember where it took place, but there was like villages where they were like, we disseminated information pro masks, and in other villages we disseminated information that was anti-mask, and then we tried to and we saw an effect size, and that had an impact. But obviously then there's all kinds of like, you know, we're going to extrapolate that to Canada. Like, why couldn't we have done that cheap trial here? I think I totally sympathize with that then.
It's like it's just amazing how comfortable people are with low quality data. There's almost this view that like low quality data is better than no data. Actually, that's not true. I think sometimes it's better to have no data.
Yeah.
We'll measure COVID prevalence by like they're measuring like the viral load in like the sewer system as opposed to just like randomly sending out people to just to
With
offer
PCR
people
tests or
tests.
whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, like it's just so crazy. Just this how data illiterate. You cannot make good decisions. It's very hard to without like high quality data. Is this should I take this drug or not? Well, I don't have any data to know. So it's like, well, you know, if some patients have told me they've had a really good experience with it, that's basically what it ends up being, right? Like, well, like, you know, like some states say masks are good, some states say masks are dumb. So like I just it, that I found the most frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, as a fellow scientist, I do wish that we had better data like that. Yeah. I try not to get too angry about it though.
Well, yeah, I guess I'm fired up a little bit because it's, you know, that's more of my bugbear. Like, you know, in terms of like the next like we're not doing it for the next pandemic. I know we're not going to. It's not like everyone's like, wow, we really should have done that in retrospect. It's like, no, like there's no sense of like, well, what could we couldn't have done anything differently, almost is I think the feel. The only thing that might be different is school lockdown. That might be the one thing that's a bit different in people's mindset, but I don't think COVID would be done any differently next time. It was a pandemic, right?
Yeah, it's true. Well, I think because also a lot of people they'll think of it as a black swan event. Like, we didn't have one for how many decades? So it'll probably just never happen ever again. That'll be a one-off. Why prepare for something that you don't think is ever going to come again?
Yeah. I don't know, Jared, if we want to wrap it up soon, but I would like to say though, one thought I have, which goes against kind of this idea that I'm like, oh, people shouldn't be too worried about COVID, which is that when the pandemic started, it became very clear that our societies just cannot effectively do lockdowns very well, like not the way that the Chinese can. And it turned out that that was a good thing, in my view, because COVID didn't end up being that dangerous of a virus. Okay. It was very bad. It killed tens of millions of people, but there is no biological limit to how deadly a virus can be with transmissibility. Now, there's correlations, right? We all know the arguments, right? It's much easier for a virus to spread quickly if it's not as dangerous to its host, blah, blah, blah. But like, there is definitely just through random chance a possibility of having an as equally infectious virus with 20 times the mortality. Like, there's no limit there to how bad it could be. And if that was the case, right, then everything I'm saying is completely different. Like, actually, you do want lockdowns. You do want insane precautions. And so I agree with you. I didn't say it, but I want to explicitly say, like, I agree when the pandemic started, we needed to err on the side of caution because we had no idea what was going on. I hope for the next time we don't get the worst of both worlds where we both first are too lax before we know what it is and how dangerous it is, but then repeat all the same mistakes, don't gather any data. Just kind of wing it, pretend we know what we're doing. So I do worry that could happen for the next pandemic.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, right? Like, I wish we were, like I said, a lot of people see it as a black swan event. I'm not one of those people. I think that there is a chance, like we just saw it happen, there's going to be a non-zero chance that it'll happen again. And I think you're right. Yeah, the lethality of COVID, we got lucky. I do wish that we could all be Taiwan, because I think Taiwan or even like New Zealand, those places, they did fantastic. They locked down and then they slowly eased back into it, right? That's the golden model, right? Whereas we here, we're just kind of like, well, we're not very good at locking down. And so then if this had been actually quite deadly, we would have been in way more trouble. So yeah, I mean, that's just a long way of me saying that you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to end on that note.
Yes, let's end every podcast with, yeah, you're absolutely right, Eric.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Again, just to repeat, like the people, the risk, of course, is that the people that are feel vindicated that COVID was hasn't been a big of a deal in the last year as their like softy liberal friends, those are the people that are gonna screw us over in the next pandemic by saying
Yeah.
like, ah, it was no problem last that last COVID, and then potentially not locking down fast enough if this ends up being the Black Death.
I guess it really makes me want to be a hoarder, or not a hoarder, a prepper. That's the word.
Yeah. Are you going to stock your basement with the toilet paper, Jared, at all
I
times now?
probably not toilet paper, but canned goods.
Okay. Canned goods expire like usually like 2027. That's like maybe a 4-year horizon. So you have
Yeah,
to
but
every.
sorry. You're looking at the, I think they're still edible though, right?
Okay.
Those are, I think they're technically best before dates.
Yes.
So you still survive. You'd hate it, but you'd still live. And I know that probably goes against what you said before, where you have to forget like your cash flow is also to have a good life. But if the world ends because of a new Black Death, then I'm going to want edible cans.
Okay.
Okay.
You want to be the last person alive.
Yeah. I think at a certain point, I do want to just maximize the years that I will be here, you know, to a certain extent.
Okay. Even if everyone else is dead, I guess. But you'll share with your family, so.
Yeah, exactly. Just, you know, small knit group of people. You can even come over, Eric, too. You,
Wow.
Netta, your whole family. We'll have enough
Thanks.
space for you too. Yeah.
That's great. We'll play Settlers of Catan for 20 years.
Oh, we have lots more board games than that. We'll at least be able to go not crazy for at least 6 months.
Awesome. Well, Jared, I'm glad we got back into this the podcast flow. Hopefully after our baby's born, after a couple of months, we'll be able to have some post-dad podcasts and
Yeah. Come
keep
in with
touch.
episode 17.
Episode 17. Yeah, and I think we already have some ideas for next time too.
Yeah, definitely. Oh man, we got so many things on the back burner.
Thank you for listening. This has been the 17th episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast. Goodbye for now.